This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You know how in football, timing is everything? You miss your window by a second and the play's already gone. The holidays are the same way. Everything happens fast, and if you're not ready, you're scrambling at the last minute. That's why Amazon Prime is the real MVP this season.
With Prime's fast, free shipping, you can make those last-minute calls look effortless. Forgot your secret Santa gift? Need something for that office party? Prime's got your back, helping you go from uh-oh to all set faster than a two-minute drill.
Absolutely, Mark, because Prime isn't just about getting things fast. It's about making sure you never miss your shot. It turns that last-minute scramble into a smooth holiday win. So this season, remember, Prime's fast delivery has your back during the holidays, especially when it's down to the wire and can't wait another minute. Last-minute gifts delivered, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to shop now.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
KYW Original Podcasts.
It's just a good conversation with somebody that you didn't know you were interested in. I'm Matt Leon, and this is One on One.
I had a guy tell me that he drove 2 hours each way. He wasn't even going to buy anything. He just drove down 2 hours just so he can come and take a picture with me and meet me. You know, you just think like, wow, I was a kid, grew up in Levittown, and just trying to do my job and, you know, live my dream. And here's people from all over the world that know my name and know my nickname. And I'm like, that's cool. That's really, really cool.
And our guest this week is professional bowler Bill O'Neill, who hails from Langhorne. Bill, thanks so much for coming in.
Matt, thanks for having me on, man. This is cool.
So as we're talking here, you just got back from a tour that took you around the globe. You were mentioned Thailand, some other places. What was that all about?
Yeah, I was gone for a couple weeks. I went to, first stop was in Bangkok. Second stop was in Seoul, South Korea. So I've been pretty well traveled here this year. Bangkok's a really cool place. So is Seoul, really. I mean, for me, I enjoy, you know, experiencing different cultures and lifestyles. And it's, you know, the bowling is the same wherever you go. You know, it's just bowling lane. So, you know, it's the same kind of idea. But yeah, there's cool places.
And this is not unusual. It sounds like you've traveled a lot through your professional bowling career.
Yeah, so I've been to Thailand, I think, 4 or 5 times. I've been to Seoul 5 or 6 times, Tokyo a bunch. All over Europe, you know, and all over the U.S. You know, we're, you know, we are a niche sport, but, you know, we're that same kind of niche in a lot of places around the world. So, you know, we are a little bit, have a little popular segments, you know, in places to where we can get over to and bowl good events, you know, all over the place.
Is Asia big for bowling, or is that just where these events happen to be?
Yeah, Japan and Korea would be our two biggest markets outside of the U.S., for a while, it was Japan. I think Korea has probably overtaken it as far as popularity and, you know, sales of you know, equipment and merchandise at this point. But yeah, those are definitely two of our biggest fan bases over there.
Is it palpable when you go over there that you're kind of it's a different type of fan base? Is it a bigger? Is it palpable like when you're at the lanes and stuff?
It's the same as it is here, really. Where like when you're inside the bowling center, yeah, you can feel it. You know, people are happy to see you. They want to take pictures, sign autographs. But as soon as you walk out the door, you know, you can go to the 7-Eleven right next door and you know, no one knows who you are. So it is kind of interesting in that way to where, like, it's very busy as far as that's concerned inside the bowling center. But as soon as you leave, it's like shuts completely off.
So has bowling always been a part of your life going back to childhood?
Oh, yeah. I got into it. I think a lot of us in bowling have a similar story to where my dad bowled, my grandfather bowled, my mother, you know, everybody was in it. So when I was a kid, like most kids, I wanted to be like my dad and be around my grandfather. And that's where they were. They were in the bowling center. They didn't compete at as high of a level as I'm at now, but that's how I got my start, was with them and just trying to be around them and, you know, and do what they were doing.
So when growing up, do you start to consider the idea that bowling can be more than just, you know, a family event or a hobby? When do you start to think like, I wonder if I could take this pro?
So it took me probably longer than a lot of other people. It was a dream, like most kids who do anything athletic wise, you dream of becoming professional in that sport. But I just went through the steps. You know, I bowled youth events in the area. Then I traveled to bowl youth events, and then I bowled in high school. And I was like, you know what? I'm in high school. I'm not bad at this. I'm bowling pretty well. And let me see if I can go to college. I went to college, and it wasn't really till like halfway through my collegiate career where I was doing really well. I won a couple of collegiate player of the years that I started to bowl some events professionally as an amateur. And then I competed. I didn't like do necessarily well, but I competed. I was cashing in the events. I was finishing in the top, you know, 20% of the field. And I said, wow, I'm young and I'm still competing at a fairly high level. Let me see if I can do it. And I'm very fortunate that I had a great family support system. So I was able to live at home for the early part of my bowling career. So I was able to, you know, take my lumps on the tour while, you know, not making a ton of money and, you know, still be able to have a roof over my head.
Is it something you talk about, like you're halfway through college and you start bowling these events? Is this something you just qualify for, or are there, for lack of a better term, are there scouts that are looking for guys, that people that they think would translate well? How does that work?
So in the beginning, when I first started to bowl professionally, it worked like golf, to where there was an exempt field. It's much smaller than golf. So, it started out as 40 guys were exempt on the tour. Then they had qualifiers each week. And then, you know, 64 guys bowled each week. So that was really cool when I first got on, because, you know, it meant that you made it. You know, you did it. You actually, you're the top 40 players in the whole world. But now that has gone away. You know, we lost some sponsors. TV deal went down. So, like, it turned into kind of just an open field. I think, you know, there's people that bowl that probably shouldn't, because they're just not at that level, and I think they find out pretty quickly that they're not. But yeah, I mean, as long as you have enough of qualifications to be a PBA member, which I believe is still like a couple years, averaging 205 in a league, which isn't which isn't really that much, you can get your PBA card and come out and bowl some events.
So do you remember your first professional tournament?
Oh yeah, pretty vividly. I was in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I just remember, you know, being like, I think I was like 24 maybe, and just being around a bunch of guys who I'd watched on television for years, and now here I am as, you know, one of their peers. You know, it was tough the first couple weeks. I was extremely nervous, and to try to, you know, get rid of those nerves in order to compete against them was tough. But I learned very quickly, you know, that they were just people like anybody else. And then when you see them, you know, in bowling centers afterwards, whatever, and they're just vulnerable people like anybody else, they just happen to bowl really well, you kind of get rid of those feelings, and you're able to, you know, just look at them as, you know, just regular people. And that made it a lot easier for me.
Did you feel right away, I mean, you talk past the nervousness, but did you feel like, I can do this? I will be able to succeed at this?
Yeah, I mean, I knew I would be able to at least at bare minimum hang on, you know. And for us, you had to stay in the top 40 in the points every year in order to keep your card. And I was pretty confident I could do that. I wasn't 100% sure I'd be able to make a full fledged living out of it and make television shows. And, you know, and for us, for the people who don't really know, only the top four or five guys each week make TV. We only have like an hour and a half to 2 hours, depending on the event. So it's tough to get your name out there and your face out there when you have to finish in the top five of every event to get on TV. So I wasn't sure I would be able to do that, but I've been doing it now this will be my 14th season coming up. So I've been doing it for a while and it's been going pretty well.
So I think you got that cup of coffee, I think it was 2004.
2005, 2006 was my rookie year. Rookie of the year, yeah.
So, and you become rookie of the year.
Yeah.
What was that like to get an award like that at this? I mean, you're at the top level, and to get something like that had to be special.
It was pretty special. I mean, as a competitor, I had to kind of downplay it a little bit because the field was a little bit watered down just because of the qualification process of it all. There wasn't a lot of people who were rookies at the time coming in at the same time. So I had to, for me to try to improve my game, I had to make sure I didn't dwell on that and think that I was somebody that I wasn't at the time, and to make sure that I kept practicing and devoting myself and my time to my craft and to get better and not just look back and think, wow, I won the rookie of the year. Big, really wasn't that big of a deal at the time.
So what is your, how do you prepare? And obviously you bowl, but I mean, how do you approach, say you've got an event on Saturday, what is your week leading up to that? How do you, I think people will be interested to know what the life is leading up to something like that.
Sure. It's a little bit different for me now as an older, I guess, ish player. I'm 37. So I guess in most sports terms, I would be, almost at the end of my career, but for bowling, it's very similar to golf. So it's kind of in the middle. Now I don't practice as much as I did when I was in my 20s and even early 30s. I focus more on the mental side of it, because at this point I know exactly what I have to do to keep my timing and all of the things needed to be sharp without having to focus on the quantity of the games that I bowl, and also trying to keep my body in better shape for stave off injuries and things like that, because those things kind of pile up after so many years of bowling. We have a lot of knees and lower back issues with throwing a 15-pound bowling ball 17 miles an hour for 20 years. You get those kind of aches and pains add up. So that's really more of what I do at this point.
What is the season for specifically? I know the event that we were talking about earlier, that wasn't a PBA. What's the PBA season run?
So right now we're like mid-January to end of May-ish. Okay. is the heart of our season. We do some other things like some overseas events or promotional appearance type stuff throughout the year, but the bulk of our season that we have on Fox and Fox Sports One is January to May.
Are you bowling 12 months a year, or do you cycle down for certain times of the year and then have almost like a, for lack of a better term, a training camp or spring training leading into a new season?
Yeah. So this part of the year, the October, November, December part of the year is when I kind of slow down a little bit. I try to at least at some point throughout each year, take like a month off. Don't bowl. Don't walk into a bowling center. Just totally get away from the game. I think it's pretty healthy. And I think you'd probably find that with most sports is that, you need that time to just decompress, get away from it all. And then when you come back, I fall in love with the game again. I'm ready to practice. I'm ready to, just get back into the swing of traveling and doing all those things, because I miss it. I miss the competition life. So I think if I don't take that kind of time away, I don't get reinvigorated like that.
And you say competition. I'm curious, for a sport like this, how much are you competing against other bowlers, and how much are you competing against yourself or against the numbers on the scoreboard?
Yeah, so it is kind of a mix of both. Because we have different parts of our events. The first part of the events will be, somewhere between anywhere from like 14 games to 24 games of like a qualifying, to where you're just beating the board and you have to, make a cut like golf. You would have, say 24 guys make a cut, or 32, or whatever the format of that event may be. So at that point, yes, you're bowling against yourself. It's very mental, but you have to be aware of what the other players are doing, because the scoring is relative. So if some weeks 220 is a really good score, and some weeks it's not. So you have to be aware of what's happening in that regard. But it's very mental in the beginning of the week, and then, when we have the next round, sometimes they're head-to-head matches. Sometimes it's like a round robin. So if 24 guys make the cut, you bowl everybody once, and you get like a bonus pin structure for winning. So then you're going head-to-head, and then it becomes a totally different animal. We have like a 30 pin bonus for winning a game. So it's winning the games almost ends up being more important than the game itself.
Do you enjoy going head-to-head, or do you enjoy the idea of going against the board more? What you know, if you had a perfect world and you could only do one, what would it be?
I love the head-to-head nature of it. I think that's just sports in general. I'm a competitor. I love to win, and just going head-to-head against someone, and you know, is everything. You know, when I played baseball and basketball as a kid, you know, you just getting that one-on-one environment is awesome. And you know, bowling against a full field of people, you know, you don't develop like rivalries or anything like that doing that. So I really, really enjoy the head-to-head nature.
So I've got it. I've read 3,300 games in PBA events. Is that ballpark close? Am I?
I think so. I don't really keep track.
Okay,
it's not something that really, really matters too much.
Okay,
you know, I for me, some guys are different. I just kind of go out and bowl, and you know, the 300 game is really, it's only one pin different than 299. So like, you know, I'm just bowling as many big games as I can, and then when I get done that game, I got to go on to the next one typically. So, yeah, so I guess 30 sounds about right.
But it's interesting, like, can you tell? I guess the thing I would equate it to is, like, I'll talk to baseball pitchers. Maybe a day they threw a no-hitter or something like that. I'm like, did you feel good coming out of the pen? And sometimes they'll say, yeah, I knew it. Or like, nah, I was kind of fighting it early, and then I found my groove. Is it similar as a bowler where can you tell in warm-ups that like, I'm sharp, I'm where I need to be, my angles are on? Or there's sometimes when, you know, I'm fighting it and I got to kind of find my way.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you can definitely feel it in practice. You know, you just feel your timing is on. You know, and that confidence, because of that, can lead to you bowling better, even if you're not, just the confidence itself. But, you know, just for a little background of our game, you know, a lot of it is determined by the lane conditions, the oil pattern. So for people who don't know, you know, there's oil on the lane. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a hard surface where every lane is different. Every event is different, you know, so we have, the lane is 60 feet and, you know, they put oil anywhere from 32 feet to 52 feet in length. They put it in different volumes. They put it in different shapes. And the idea of the game is to get the ball to hit the head pin. And then for right-handers, the three pin, which is the one next to it. And you have to hit that at the right angle in order to maximize your chances of striking. So they can put oil on the lane to make it easier or harder to hit that spot. So a lot of the, you know, 300s and high scores are very much based on the environment that we're playing in. So, you know, not all 300s are, you know, are the same, you know, because of that.
And I'd never heard that before. So is that something you're going to lane X and you've bowled there seven events over your career? Is it always the same oil setup that it's different in different places, but you kind of know that what you're going to get at place X, or do they purposely change it around like they move a hole in golf?
Yes, so they do. They change it, you know, quite a bit. Some places, because of the surface of the lanes are different as well, and the topography of the lanes are different as well. Even though they look flat, you know, they're being manually put in. So some places, the lanes are screwed down tighter than others, so it creates more of a bow in the lane. So that makes the ball, you know, not hook as much. But those things, you never know until you actually throw the ball. It's very, very much invisible. So certain places we go to, they have to kind of tailor the oil patterns to certain lanes. But yeah, we could bowl in a center 10 years in a row, and we could have 10 different oil patterns with 10 different winners. But you know, certain characteristics are, you know, you'll find with a center to where you'll play the lanes a similar way. But yeah, it's all over the place.
I've watched bowling on TV, and preparing for this, I was watching some YouTube videos of you, and the places can get raucous as a match is going on. How much do you thrive and feed off of that atmosphere? Because it really looks like a ton of fun to be in the middle of.
Yeah, so we have a couple of different places that we go that are loud. One in particular is in Portland, Maine, which is kind of a place where the people didn't necessarily bowl. Really, they bowled, but they weren't bowlers. If that makes sense, mm-hmm. they you know, they weren't really into the, you know, the nuances of the game, but they loved it. So when we started to come there, that's the way they were kind of treating us like when they bowled league, and they were loud. They were dressing up in costumes. They were doing things that you would do at like a football game, which we never had, which we ended up, people thought we would hate it. We loved it. We loved every minute of it. And we have other places that it's more old school to where it's dead silent when we bowl, you know, on TV. And the dead silence is so much worse.
Right. I've heard that.
It's so much harder. You know, it's like you could hear every little thing, and it creates so much more anxiety when it's that quiet. So the place we go in Portland makes it, you know, we bowled our biggest event there, our biggest money event there this year was the PBA playoffs. It was, you know, modeled after the golf kind of one, the FedEx Cup a little bit. And so that was the top four ended up bowling in Portland in June, and they were still just as loud. And, you know, we were bowling for, you know, first place was $100,000, and, you know, they were screaming and cheering and chanting and doing all those things. And it made it so much easier to compete because of that.
Do you have shots from your career that you'll never forget? The moments, but like, you know, 10th frame comeback, stuff like that. And what are some of those that if I ask you reflect on your career that would come rushing back for you?
Yeah, sure. So the moment I'll never forget, I won the U.S. Opens, my only major title in 2010, and that was for my second title on the tour. So that usually the U.S. Open is kind of reserved for like people who've been out there a while. It's a long, grueling event. We bowl in the hardest lane condition. So for me to win that event as such a younger type player on the tour, that was like, that was it for me. That's kind of when my career kind of took off. But I won that tournament. The last game that I bowled was kind of a blowout. So it wasn't, I didn't, you know, have the exact, you know, that one particular moment. But there was one event that I bowled, I think it was like 5 years ago. And I needed two strikes in the 10th to win the title. And I got it. And it was a match that I was never supposed to win. You know, the guy, just the way that the lane conditions were, they didn't suit me at all. It's hard to really explain to everybody, so I don't really want to get into too much of the minutia of it. But I needed two strikes, and you know, like if I had to do it all over again, I bowled like a 240 something, 247 or something to win. And if I bowled that game 100 times on that, I might not have bowled 240 again. And so, like, and to throw two strikes to win, you know, was definitely a TV moment that I'll never forget.
I mentioned I watched some YouTube videos, and I saw your nickname is the Real Deal. What is the origin of that? Because I saw people chanting that in the one I watched specifically. You were going for a 300 game,
right,
in the 10th frame. And it was great. And it had to be cool to be in there. What's the origin of the Real Deal?
So when I was in college.
This is Saginaw Valley State.
Yeah. Yeah. I was my freshman year there. I had two friends who had gone to that school the year before, and they were talking to the coach about recruiting me. Hey, you got to get my buddy Bill. You know, and so, and you know, it's a school in Michigan. So, like, you know, bowling, the word doesn't travel as fast at that time. So, they happened to bowl an event in New Jersey, and I came out and tried out. And you know, the guy wanted me, so then I came there. And the very very first tournament that we bowled, I won the singles portion of it. So the coach he wasn't meaning it to be a nickname. He just said to my buddies, like, I guess you guys were right. I guess he is the real deal. And then. It rhymes with my last name.
Right.
So I think it just kind of stuck, you know, because of that. I've hated it ever since. because, you know, I started to go out on tour and I was a rookie. I'm amongst all these guys, you know, future Hall of Fame players, and I'm getting announced in my rookie year in these pro-ams as the real deal. And I was like, oh, this is a kind of lofty expectations.
Did you have anybody that you could tell was put off by it, that you felt like that they were kind of, oh, really?
Not really. I think, you know, the bowling community is pretty small in that way. So I think that, you know, that's the story kind of will travel fast enough, and it's such a small community that, you know, everybody kind of gets it. And I never was like, I wasn't like signing my autograph and then putting like in quotes the real deal. And then, you know what I mean? I wasn't doing anything to kind of promote the name. So, and I think, you know, once people got to know me a little bit, it was easier for them to understand that it wasn't really my personality to go around and just shout that from the rooftops.
But that being said, though, like, it has to be cool to have people chanting something like that when you're, you know, trying to finish off. That's got to be a pretty cool rush.
I mean, even though I've been doing this for 14 years, it's still really cool to me that people will look at me in that way, you know, for anything. Like, I just did an event in Kansas City. I was doing an appearance at a pro shop, and I had a guy tell me that he drove 2 hours each way. Just he wasn't even going to buy anything. He just drove down 2 hours just so he can come and take a picture with me and meet me. And I'm like, that's cool. That's really, really cool. And like, it can get overwhelming at times, you know, with, you know, the pictures and the autographs, stuff like that. But those kind of stories are, make it all worthwhile. Like, you know, you just think like, wow, I was a kid from, you know, grew up in Levittown and just trying to do my job and, you know, live my dream. And here's people from all over the world that know my name and know my nickname and now want to drive hours to come meet me. It's pretty cool.
Time to take a break on One-on-One. We will have more with professional bowler Bill O'Neill right after this.
They're on a journey through breweries and watering holes throughout the region.
It actually tastes like apple pie in a glass.
Okay, I'm getting it now. Now I'm getting the pie.
John McDevitt and Paul Kurtz are the Beer and Booze Bros. Don't miss any of their podcasts.
That's all I need, another addiction.
On the radio.com app or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back. Our guest this week on One-on-One, professional bowler Bill O'Neill. Toughest shot in bowling. I mean, is it the 7-10 split that we hear so much about that even like the people that never bowl are aware of it?
Sure, yeah, that's like because it's all luck. You know, you're there's no space to actually like slide the pin over. So you're just hitting it into the back and hoping that it gets the action.
The...
Yeah, it hits something hard by chance and it bounces out. Like it's very, very luck based and you know, it doesn't really happen that often. Now you'll get pins that bounce out onto the deck or maybe into the back into the gutter, but the you know, the odds of it actually bouncing out and ending in the right spot is, you know, super luck based. I think I've only done it like twice, I think, in my whole life.
What is the toughest shot that isn't luck based, if you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Is there a combination that you can practice and work on it, and what is it?
Right. So like some of the splits we know that they're just such a low percentage chance of making that most of the time we don't like try to make them. So like you have like the 4-10, which is, you know, the pin up from the 7 and the 10 pin. So you know, there's not, it's a very minuscule chance to be able to clip that pin and slide it over into it. So like, you know, we're just hitting the 4 pin to try to get. Same goes for like the 6-7. So it ends up being like the ones that are easier, but then they become harder because you're supposed to make them too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, so you have like the 3-10. So there's like a little bit of a gap between the 3 and the 10 pin, and you're trying to hit the right side of the 3 pin. So you almost like overanalyze it because you're trying to make it. So, for the makeable splits, it would be like, you know, the 2-10 would be the hardest one. So it's, you know, the 2 pins on the left side, the 10 pins on the right side. You know, but you can make that probably, you know, we probably make that 25% of the time, I would say.
Do you practice specific things like that? Like, do you have setups where today I'm going to work on maybe not the 2-10, but certain things, or do you just bowl to work out and whatever you get, you just work? And am I making sense?
No, yes. Yeah. Well, like, so I will practice my spare shooting.
Mm-hmm.
So, because I can throw it, straight when I need to, I stand in the same spot and look at the same thing, you know, for all my spares. I mean, I move around the lane for different spares, but I know that if I'm shooting the 10 pin, I'm standing here and I'm throwing it here. So when I shoot the 3-10, I'm standing here throwing it there. And so it's just instinctual at this point. So I'll go in and practice and make sure that my timing is right and that I'm hitting the spots I need to hit and make sure there's nothing out of line with my swing or my footwork or anything like that to make the ball go offline. But not necessarily practicing them to like get better at them or find a new way to make them. Like that's pretty much all done already. And, you know, I just got to go out and execute it and hit the shot.
You mentioned Portland, Maine being a great venue. What are some other hotbeds that you enjoy going and that the PBA is really welcomed and it's a fun place to take part?
Yeah. So typically like the smaller towns are better. Even before I was on the tour, like Erie, Pennsylvania was always one that people love because it's just the small town nature of it kind of lends to bowling as well. We used to bowl in Oregon, Medford, Oregon. That was cool. But we have a pretty good following. We used to bowl the US Open in New Brunswick, New Jersey.
Okay.
And that was my favorite event. The crowds were great. We used to have a ton of people there. You know, you pull people from New York and Jersey and Pennsylvania, and that was always probably the biggest crowds that we would get. So that, but we don't bowl there anymore. But Indianapolis is always a good one. Detroit. Detroit, Michigan is always super popular. Like, it's the biggest bowling association in the United States is in Detroit. So that's, you know, we always tend to get great crowds, people who are super knowledgeable about the game, and, you know, they make it a lot of fun.
What is your favorite part of being a pro bowler?
I mean, aside from, you know, the obvious, being able to, like, live my dream, you know, and not necessarily having a real job, I guess would be a bonus. But, you know, the travel, I think, is cool. You know, it is really hard to leave my family and travel all over the world. But when I'm done bowling, I'm going to get to say that, you know, I've been to all these places. You know, I've gotten to go to, you know, places all over Europe. I've been to, you know, Qatar and Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, Kuwait. Like, I've done all those places bowling. You know, not all the best places to go or enjoy, but I've been to, you know, I don't know, 20 countries, I think, at this point. So not many people get to say that they can do that while also, you know, doing it for their job and, you know, living their dream.
The place you are, either in the U.S. or in the world, the place that you were most surprised that bowling was popular?
Popular.
Or I should say, like, where, yeah, like, you were like, wow, I did not expect this type of turnout.
You know, I think the first time that I went to Tokyo, I think, was a shock. I mean, now that I'm a little older, I understand, mm-hmm. you know, the business side of it and how many bowling balls we sell over there and whatnot. But when I first went over there, I think I was maybe like my second or third year on the tour, and I got to qualify for this special event over there, and all these people were in the bowling center, and I'm like, wow, I just traveled, it's been 14 hours on a plane to get here, and this many people are still in, you know, are into bowling in this way. It was really neat. Like, I just didn't, you know, and you know, you have a huge language barrier. Most of the people over there don't speak any English, so you know, the ones that come watch us bowl anyway, so they just know enough to get you to sign whatever they want signed and take a picture, and they were just all really excited to see us. It was, you know, that was an eye-opening experience for me.
Is there, and I say this having no idea, but I know, obviously, fantasy football's big, fantasy golf. Is there a fantasy bowling type of thing?
We tried some years ago, and it just didn't really take off within the bowling community mm-hmm. itself. I mean, I think it's something we should try to do again.
I would think it lends itself to it.
Yeah, and like every sport, gambling really drives the sport.
Right.
It's really, I mean, a really huge piece of the sport. But it's so hard for us to incorporate the gambling into what we do, because I think so many people have, I don't know, inside knowledge, and everything is so small
mm-hmm.
that it's hard to, like, gamble on it. Because I don't know, but the fantasy side of it's something that, you know, we sure should take advantage of. I mean, it, you know,
because I think
see why not.
I kind of think it would fall similar to golf and NASCAR, those types of things where, you know, it's an individual, but you can put teams together and stuff like that, where I think it would, you know, I'll make a call. I don't, but
yeah, see what you can do there. I mean, I I'm not sure, actually. It's a great question, because I'm not sure why we stopped, really. But yeah, I think like 4 or 5 years ago, it started to catch some steam and people were doing it, and then it just kind of went away. Yeah, maybe we'll see if we can get that going again.
What is next for you? As we're talking here, it is mid-October. What's next couple weeks look like for you?
Yeah, so we go to, we have the U.S. Open, which is the last, like, main big, you know, the big event we have of the year, just outside of Charlotte. So that'll be the 23rd of October to the 30th. And then I qualified for a special event in China. So that'll be just before Thanksgiving. So that'll be just, you know, 8 PBA players are going over to bowl, you know, a small event with 8 Chinese bowlers, so that'll be interesting. Be my first time over there, so we'll see what happens.
How many bowling balls do you have? Do you rotate through, or do you have one that until something happens you use?
Oh no, I have tons. So we, you know, because of what I was explaining earlier about the lane conditions, the bowling balls are very important. So we have balls that, you know, the cores are different, and the cover stocks are different. So the covers are different textures to make them grip the lane sooner, grip the lane further down. You know, it's all about friction, the creating the you know, higher or lower friction on the lane surface, you know, and matched with the oil. So, I mean, we go through so many ball balls, people wouldn't even, people wouldn't even be able to fathom. I mean, like, just, I mean, the company that sponsors me has four brands of bowling balls. And, you know, we come out with, I don't know, 25 different balls every year. And you know, a lot of them are similar with just different colors and stuff. But for the most part, you know, it's 15 new balls every year or whatever, you know, with different cores and covers. And it's like, it's very complicated. And that, you know, it's part of the reason why bowling has a hard time gaining any serious traction is because everything we do is so hidden and invisible and complicated. So, yeah, I mean, there's just people will see me wheeling a three ball bag into a bowling center and they're like, how do you have so many balls? I'm like, well, I actually only just brought three and I got, you know, 50 of them in my garage. You know, mm-hmm. It's an interesting thing.
Can you tell, like, right away, like, one run with a ball, like, all right, I like this one, or that, not going to work?
Yeah, I can tell pretty quickly at this point. You know, like, just there's certain way the ball rolls down the lane that I like and some ways that they don't. And then when we go to different places with different, you know, lengths and volumes of oil, you know, you can see pretty quickly, you know, oh, this ball is just hooks way too much, or this one hooks way too little. And, you know, you identify it pretty quickly.
And I'm curious, you mentioned the fascinating thing about the oil, the different places. Was that something you knew, like, in college and younger, or is that something that you didn't quite realize until you start really traveling and stuff, and all of a sudden a shot that at point A was right on, you're doing the same thing, you're not getting the same kind of action? How did you learn about that?
Yeah, so, like, I mean, it's a pretty well-known thing in bowling about the oil patterns, but, like, the experience of continuing to do it, you recognize things faster. So, like, you know, we always knew about the difference of the, you know, of the lanes and the oil patterns, but you're not really supremely educated on it. So you're still kind of going in blind, and, you know, the experience of bowling tournament after tournament after tournament, that's what gives you all the, you know, the knowledge and the understanding of, you know, where's the best part of the lane to play for you. You know, you could be playing in the first arrow, throwing it over the fifth arrow or whatever. But yeah, it just all comes with experience.
What's the most you've bowled in a day? Like, what is the most
games,
frames, yeah, games, so, that you've...
There was this one tournament I bowled in Finland that I bowled. The finals were... Two part of the finals were on the same day, and then they had what you would see on television normally, which we call is a stepladder. So, like, you know, you have, say, four guys make it, four bowls three, winner bowls two. And that day I bowled 25 games, plus, you know, warm-ups between it, you know, each round. So yeah, that was a brutal day. When I got done, I was just ready to just lay down.
Yeah. And I mean, what's your, like, your shoulder like the next morning? I mean, that's, even for someone that's a professional, that's an obscene amount of bowling.
Yeah. So that's a question I get a lot. And the shoulder is actually one of the least injured parts of it. Yeah. Because when we do it properly, the shoulder's not really, it's not really used. It's just kind of, and I think our body is more made for our shoulder to go in that direction than it would be the other way if you're pitching, say, or mm-hmm. throwing a football. So we get all of our power, just like most sports, from our legs. How fast you know, can get to the line, you get in different leverage positions to create the power. So for us, it's mostly the legs and lower back is what gets the most tired. Maybe the forearm too, because, you know, just the way we're, you know, the way you create revolutions on the ball is basically the same way you spin a yo-yo. So, like, you're not actually, like, you're not turning your, people think you like turn your elbow or you lift. But it's really the opposite. You really have to, like, you know, load your wrist and kind of cup it, and then your elbow bends, and then you unload it, basically like you would do with a yo-yo. And that's how you create the, you know, as many revolutions as you can.
Do you feel the sport gets the respect it deserves? And I ask that because it strikes me, if you say no, it's because everybody thinks they could do it.
Yeah, I think there is a piece of it that people think that they can do it.
Because they've bowled 10 times in their life. And,
yeah,
you know,
for a lot of different reasons. We have a capped scoring system, right? We only 300 is the highest you can go, and it's easily achievable for a lot of people. We're like, say, golf, like, nobody birdies every hole. Like, it's not an achievable thing. You know, and the things that we do are a lot more hidden. You know, I'm telling you about the oil patterns. Even people who bowl league and average 210 or 220 don't quite understand what it is that we're doing. So I think it makes it really difficult to get the credit maybe we think we deserve from outside of the industry when the people that are kind of in on the inside don't really quite understand what it is that we're doing. And that's, you know, I don't think we can sit here as professional bowlers and like scream about, you know, respect when, you know, we haven't really done the things that we need to do as a, as an industry, as athletes ourselves, to educate people on what it is that we do, or even, you know, show people how hard it is, or, you know, we've had plenty of people, you know, myself included, who've like been on TV just not looking athletic. You know, it's just like, you know, we've done those things. So I think it's a, you know, it's a slow climb out of that process. And I don't think any of us think that we're headed towards a direction where we're going to be some mainstream, sport, but you know, we can incrementally get better and, you know, and, you know, hopefully, you know, draw some younger viewers to the TV.
Do you have a, do you like a home lane, like a place that is considered like your place?
Yeah. So the place that I practice at the most, is AMF Bristol Pike Lanes. It's in Croydon. I bowled Levittown Lanes in Levittown for quite a while. So those would be the two places that I, you know, would call home. You know, just my son bowls Saturday morning league at Bristol Pike. So it's just a place where I end up, you know, it's most convenient for me. It's, you know, right down the street from my house. So, you know, it makes it a little easier to get in and out of there.
Are you able to, I don't know how it, do you ever just bowl for pleasure? And what I mean by that is just a couple friends or you and your son, or are you always on as a competitor and you can never just kind of let go and just have it be just a friendly game? If am I making
yeah,
sense?
No, totally. Yeah. I don't bowl for what I guess you would consider fun. Mm-hmm. Just because I got to get away when I'm right. when I'm not. You know, it's like because you treat it as a job, so like you don't want to continue to do your job when you're not doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But if my son asked me to, then you know, then I do. That's a little bit different. I think the last time I bowled for like enjoyment, I think I was at my neighbor's 40th birthday party a couple years ago. We went to, I forget if it was North Bowl or South Bowl, one of those two. You know, and I went down there and I looked like a goof because I brought my own ball and stuff, and I probably wouldn't do that again. But yeah, that would probably be the last time. And the time before that, I couldn't even remember. So very, very rarely do I go out and bowl for enjoyment.
And you mentioned your son does a weekends and stuff. Like, does he realize how special what you do is, like as a professional bowler, and that not a lot of people do this for a living?
Not really. You know, like he's only six, so he enjoys watching me on TV, but that's all he knows.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so he doesn't really get it. You know, like he's very, very into basketball as well. So we've done a couple events with Chris Paul. Chris Paul has been a partner of ours for a long time. We've done a couple of, you know, his like charity events, and you know, they're on TV. So he thinks that like I know Chris Paul like at like a friendship level,
right.
and he thinks I know all the guys in that way. So he just got a pair of LeBron sneakers, and he asked me to text LeBron to tell him that he got a pair of shoes. And I said, well, I don't really know LeBron like that. So he doesn't, you know, he just thinks that that's normal. Whatever I do, I'm just on TV. I know everybody else is on TV, and that's how the world works, according to him.
And final question: I put you in charge of professional bowling. Is there one thing, one idea that you would like to implement that you think might elevate the sport to a higher level, or get it into more markets, to stuff like that? Is there one idea you think?
Yeah, I mean, we talk about this a lot, and you know, we were at the for a lot of years. You know, we just didn't have the funds, you know, to step out and create a lot of new and cool things that we do. But for I don't know how much you've ever watched, if you've ever seen darts on TV. All right, so I think that's a model that like we can use, and the because we're a tough sport to watch as a spectator, because it's you can't put people around the lanes, you know, it's hidden. Everything is, you know, you can only see the pins from certain places in a bowling center. So the way darts does it is they have what's worse spectator game than darts? So the board's really small. Like, why would anybody go anywhere to watch people play darts? It'd be like 10 people around. but they set it up to where there's giant screens, and they create events out of these, you know, dart matches. And I think that's the thing that we could do the most is, you know, make the sport almost secondary to the event. And I think a lot of sports do that, really. I mean, if you look at football, if they told people that they couldn't drink or tailgate at any event, the experience at home is probably better. You know, so like you take out the event nature of anything, and we don't really have that right now. The sport has to stand alone. So I think if we got to a position where we could be, our TV shows could be in, arenas to where we have, create a party-like atmosphere and have people like hanging out and doing other things, and then can look up and say, oh, wow, there's bowling going on too. And I think that's what we do a lot of times with a lot of other things. And I've been to a couple golf tournaments, and that's very much how golf is. I mean, there's so many things going on at the golf course that, a lot of times you're just peeking in on what's really happening on the course. So I think that's hopefully an avenue that we can go. I don't really know how feasible it is, but that's what I would like to do for sure.
Bill O'Neill, thanks so much for stopping by.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
And that will do it for this week's episode. One-on-One is an original sports podcast from KYW News Radio. If you like the show and want to help us out, make sure you are subscribed so you don't miss an episode. And you can help more people find out about the podcast by finding the show on Apple Podcasts and leaving a rating and a review. You can follow the show on Twitter at One-on-One Pod, and you can follow me on Twitter as well at MattLeon1060. You can follow Bill on Twitter at Bill_O'Neill. My name is Matt Leon. Come back next week for another good conversation with someone you should know more about.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
You know how in football, timing is everything? You miss your window by a second, and the play's already gone. The holidays are the same way. Everything happens fast, and if you're not ready, you're scrambling at the last minute. That's why Amazon Prime is the real MVP this season.
With Prime's fast, free shipping, you can make those last-minute calls look effortless. Forgot your secret Santa gift? Need something for that office party? Prime's got your back, helping you go from uh-oh to all set faster than a two-minute drill.
Absolutely, Mark, because Prime isn't just about getting things fast. It's about making sure you never miss your shot. It turns that last-minute scramble into a smooth holiday win. So this season, remember, Prime's fast delivery has your back during the holidays, especially when it's down to the wire and can't wait another minute. Last-minute gifts delivered, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to shop now.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
You're jamming your favorite song, and while you aren't missing a beat, you could be missing a signal from your body. It's an SOS from your kidneys, and it doesn't sound like music at all. It's silent. High blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, and other risk factors can quietly stress the kidneys, leading to negative impacts on the heart. That's why you should ask your doctor about a simple urine test called UACR. Most miss the signal for hidden kidney disease and related heart risk. You shouldn't. Visit DetectTheSOS.com today to learn more.
This holiday season, choose gifts that feel thoughtful and practical with Omaha Steaks. Whether you're hosting or gifting, they deliver the world's best steak experience, and it makes you look like you planned way ahead. They've got USDA-certified tender steaks, juicy burgers, comfort meals, and tons more. Gifting Omaha Steaks is honestly one of the easiest wins. Everything arrives beautifully packaged, super convenient, and the quality is unbelievable. Their filet mignons are some of the most tender I've ever had. And the variety means you can personalize every gift. Plus, orders placed by 6 p.m. Eastern ship same day. And everything is backed by their 100% guarantee. It's holiday gifting made simple. Save big on gourmet gifts and more holiday favorites with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com for 50% off site-wide during their Sizzle All the Way sale. And for an extra $35 off, use promo code T-Bone at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. That's omahasteaks.com, code T-Bone.